It's Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and you're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, this week's edition of Food Friday will explore how air fryers, slow cookers, and pressure cookers can make life easier in the kitchen, if you do it right. First, many people tune into the Super Bowl just to watch those commercials. $7 million for 30 seconds this year, according to NBC. But this year, even more of those advertisements will be for gambling, sports gambling to be specific. Betting on the Super Bowl or any sport is now legal in over half of all U.S. states, including Wisconsin. But right now, it's only offered at one Oneida Casino in Green Bay. It's become a multi-billion dollar industry in no time, generating significant tax revenues where it's legal and also raising concerns about the harmful side of gambling addiction. We're learning more about what legal sports gambling is doing to us, and we want to hear from you and what you think at 1-800-642-1234. You gamble on sports? You win, you lose? Have you placed any bets on the Super Bowl this year? What is it? Rams are 4-point favorites, I believe, for Sunday. Do you plan to? Is it fun for you? Or do you see any problems with it? Call us, 1-800-642-1234, and join our conversation. It's 1-800-642-1234. You can always post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email us ideas@wpr.org. Les Burnell is the national director of the nonprofit group Stop Predatory Gambling. Les, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me today.
Let's start with just some sense of how massive this sports betting industry has become and how quickly it's gotten there.
Yeah, it's spread now to more than 30 states in just a kind of at light speed. Every state government has no understanding of what they're legalizing here, because the end game isn't really just commercialized sports gambling. Commercialized sports gambling is just really a tool to get citizens to sign up online. What the end game here is to open up really online casino gambling into every home, every dorm room, every smartphone in a community. You know, so it's like, you know, having Las Vegas right in your bedroom. And particularly if you have kids, you know, right on their tablets and their computers, because they're going to be the demographic most affected by this massive expansion of predatory gambling.
So you see it as the pathway towards a casino in every home, but what built that pathway? How is this possible?
Yeah, so, you know, and it's important for your listeners to understand that there was no grassroots movement for commercialized sports gambling in the United States, in Wisconsin or in any other state. This was driven by very powerful financial interests, billion-dollar financial interests, some professional sports team owners who are also billionaires, and you had public officials who were looking for more and more money to raise for public services without having to raise taxes on middle-income and upper-income folks. And so the ultimate kind of way we've raised revenue over the last, you know, 30 years in most states, including in Wisconsin, what we continue to turn to are these more and more extreme forms of commercialized gambling. And I think it's important for your listeners to understand, like, when we say commercialized gambling, we're talking about when you're running gambling as a business, right? So if you and I had a friendly wager on the Super Bowl, right, we had a, you know, $20 wager, or we go golfing and, you know, we have a friendly wager on the 18th hole, those types of things. You have an office Super Bowl pool. Like, those are social gambling. You know, predatory gambling is when you're running gambling as a business. And the reason why it's been illegal and for most of American history is because at its core, it's a form of financial fraud. It's a big con. And that's what separates it from other vices, even like tobacco and alcohol. It's a financial exchange that is literally mathematically stacked against you. It's like price gouging and false advertising, both of which are illegal in Wisconsin and in most states. So you have these very powerful financial interests that stand to make billions of dollars by encouraging citizens to sign up and place wagers on sporting events relentlessly, as if you're not a sports fan anymore in Wisconsin or any other state if you don't have money on the game.
Les Burnell, our guest, the national director of the not-for-profit Stop Predatory Gambling, as you are certain to see gambling ads during the Super Bowl on Sunday, and would be interested in knowing what you think as sports gambling has taken off. At 1-800-642-1234 to join our conversation with our guest. Let's go to Pat in Three Lakes this afternoon. Pat, good afternoon. You're on Central Time.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I think sports gambling is a... it's first of all, it's addictive. Secondly, it destroys people. It destroys families. It's something that shouldn't be allowed. People can't even sit down on a Sunday afternoon now and watch a football game without having a stake in it. And most of the time, stake is going to be a losing stake. And the problem with it is that once you start to lose, you lose more and more and more because you'll never gain it back.
Pat, how do you know about the effects of gambling?
I know about it because I'm kind of a gambler. I go to Las Vegas occasionally, and I gamble. I play things that I can afford. I know how to gamble. But I do know that even Las Vegas is addictive, but at least you have to get into an airplane and fly to Las Vegas and go and play. Go to an Indian casino, it's the same thing. You have to make the effort to go in there. But when you can pick up your phone or your internet and make a bet on a football game and bet on just about anything you want to bet on, you're going to lose.
Pat, I appreciate the perspective. Addictive, destructive, and yet the question about whether or not prohibition is effective. Les?
So I think the word you use for prohibition, respectfully, is the wrong word.
Okay.
We've already been able to place sports bets amongst each other for 100 years. Like, it's not illegal for you and I to place a wager with one another. What's illegal is to run commercialized gambling as a business. Okay, to do it as a business because it's been illegal for most of U.S. history because it's an inherently a form of consumer financial fraud like price gouging and false advertising.
But haven't we always seen that less as the house always wins? That's our understanding about gambling going into it.
That's right, and that's right. So the more I think Pat said it really eloquently. Like, this isn't about whether or not people gamble. If people want to be reckless with their money or do whatever they want to do, that's up to them. Like, this is a government program in Wisconsin and in most states. Like, this is only legal if you partner with state government. You and I can't go open up our own sports book. It's only legal if you partner with state government and you cut in state government and give them a portion of the profits.
Then, Les, as you see it, and I apologize for cutting in here, but just to be clear, as you see it, is this why some states have been eager to legalize sports betting? Is the bottom line that they see?
The state public, most public officials have become blinded by greed. This is a push by, really, is one word that defines this better than anything else, and that's greed. It's the public official. It's public officials who are acting with greed. You have these billion-dollar gambling corporations who are acting out of greed. You have these massive media companies who are benefiting immensely by all the advertising, and you have these professional sports team owners who are profiting it as well. But you, the everyday citizen, like, you're suffering from this. If you have kids, like, kids today are growing up thinking that gambling and sports are one and the same. Like, you're not a sport. If you go, we actually had a young man that contacted us. He's a very successful athlete in the Northeast, and all in his locker room, the kids, they're talking about, the latest, music hit or whatever. They're talking about what they're going to place for parlay bets that weekend on sports gambling. Their coach talks about what games he's going to bet on that weekend. I mean, that's a transformative experience for young people today. So that's why in places of the world that have experimented with this, like, it's been a massive failure, particularly like the United Kingdom, where amongst all the major issues that the United Kingdom is dealing with at the moment, Brexit, COVID, so on, the top five issue in the UK today is gambling reform because they have an epidemic of child gambling because of what's happened. Those same companies now are being pushed out of the UK and they're setting up shop and partnering with US companies like DraftKings and FanDuel and so on.
Les Burnell, our guest, national director of the nonprofit group Stop Predatory Gambling. And we're talking about sports betting this afternoon with the certainty of seeing ads during the Super Bowl on Sunday, inviting you to partake and put your money on the line. Gambling line, that is. So you can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. Have you gone to Wisconsin's Oneida Casino to gamble on sports? What was that like for you? Do you want to see the state legalize sports betting everywhere across the board? And would you bet on sports if you could do it legally from your home or from anywhere? Join us at 1-800-642-1234. That phone number is 1-800-642-1234. Email open as well this afternoon for you at ideas@wpr.org. Conversation continues coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and right now we're picking up the conversation about sports betting with Les Burnell, director of the group Stop Predatory Gambling. And we want to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. Are you concerned about the influx of sports gambling advertising? Why or why not? And do you think sports betting should be treated differently than regular gambling? Do you think it makes sports more fun, or do you avoid gambling altogether? 1-800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Les Burnell, our guest, and he joins us from Stop Predatory Gambling. And the other aspect that our caller Pat brought up before the break, Les, was that how technology has changed gambling, how it has made the opportunity for an app to put gambling in your pocket at any time and available at any time. How is that changing what we do with how we put our money down?
Yeah. So the way that these commercialized gambling operators make money and in relation to state government, because they're partners in this, is they make money by continually providing more and more access to commercialized gambling with more and more extreme forms of commercialized gambling. So it's you're getting constant access to it, you know, at more and higher price points. And so the technology now allows you, you know, like when we talk about sports gambling, it's not a traditional sports bet like we all think of, like I'll pick the Packers by 3.5 over the Bears in a football game, you know, 3.5 points. Now it's like, is the next play in this game going to be a run or a pass? You know, is Steph Curry going to hit 3 3-pointers in the first quarter of this game? Like, anything you can imagine, they're encouraging you to wager. And so even when it's not a traditional U.S. sporting event, these companies like DraftKings, FanDuel, you know, MGM, like they're encouraging you to bet like on Hungarian basketball, you know, in the middle of the day, and not just on the winner, like is the score going to end is in an even or odd number? So what they're doing is feeding people constant action, you know, getting people, it's, you know, because the pursuit is, it's just, you know, you kind of have a boring day at work. Yeah. Well, look, I can bet on Hungarian basketball. Like it's, you know, get constant action. And this is being done in partnership with these billion-dollar gambling corporations with state governments. It's America's biggest, most neglected problem. And the last thing I want to say, just so your listeners have some context for this, well, you're talking state lotteries, brick-and-mortar casinos, and now online gambling, sports gambling. Like, commercialized gambling is the public voice of American government today to most citizens. It's what we advertise to the American people, including the citizens of Wisconsin, more than what we advertise anything else. And 2/3 of the public doesn't gamble at all. So like when we talk about inequality, wealth inequality, and you know, we need to raise the minimum wage and tax billionaires and all these other important issues that people are debating, like this is exhibit A. Like, you know, this issue affects all that. Over the next 8 years, the American people are going to lose more than $1 trillion of personal wealth to government-sanctioned gambling. And that's according to The Economist, you know, and from a couple of years ago, we are currently losing $120 billion a year already to commercialized gambling of our personal wealth. It's America's biggest, most neglected problem.
Les Burnell, our guest, National Director of Stop Predatory Gambling, and your calls as we continue at 1-800-642-1234, where Andrew in Minnesota is standing by. Andrew, good afternoon.
Yeah, good afternoon to you both. So, disclaimer, I am in no way advocating that anybody go gamble on account of, I'm not about it. I certainly work too hard for my money to give it away to other people, right? Or at least for the sake of trying to increase my wealth. But I heard you say earlier that commercializing or a business, if it's like a private citizen for who's trying to run a gambling operation, you refer to it as like a con and also a fraud. Now, as I understand it, if somebody is going to a bookie and they are placing a bet, they are aware of the odds, even though they are not always, they're always favorable to the house, right? But they're fully aware of that. So I don't understand in what way it is considered a fraud or a con. And I was hoping you could elaborate on that.
Andrew, thank you. Les?
So Yeah. So when whether it's a state lottery, a brick and mortar casino, and now sports gambling, it is absolutely a con. It's not marketed as they don't put, hey, your chances of losing this money is almost 100% certain. Like when you, if you and I were to place a friendly wager with each other, you know, that's one thing. But when you bet against the house, it is absolutely a mathematical certainty that the longer you participate in it, you are going to lose all your money. So when you watch these advertisements on during football games or basketball games, like they're not saying, you know, you're guaranteed to lose your money. They're saying this is where the winners bet. You know, this is your chance, you know, to get this huge jackpot. Get this $2,000 risk-free bet by signing up. You know, like it, the whole thing is a con. And it's important to note, commercialized gambling, because it's organized or led by the state governments in our country, they're exempt from truth and advertising regulations under the Federal Trade Commission. They're the only business in America that's exempt from these rules.
I am glad you brought this up, because I would be curious to hear from you about ideas on ad regulation or rules on commercials that may be similar to alcohol and tobacco that we've seen in the not so recent past. Les?
Yeah, at a bare minimum, the requirement should be for any state is to have the same restrictions on commercialized gambling advertising that we do for tobacco. You know, many of your listeners will know that in 2013, the American Psychological Association released its DSM-5, which is like this manual for, you know, public health, and insurance companies use it to dictate, you know, coverages and that type of stuff. They labeled gambling addiction an addiction like being addicted to cocaine, heroin, opioids. Okay. We don't promote those relentlessly on television. Like those are, you know, this idea that we're promoting a highly addictive product like this, exempt from truth and advertising regulations. The only reason why it happens is because the states are using this as a revenue source. You know, it's the ultimate budget gimmick. And it's time that Wisconsin and other states, you know, we started relying on real taxation, not budget gimmicks that hurt the American people like predatory gambling does.
Let's return to your calls now at 1-800-642-1234, where Karen in Jefferson is standing by. Karen, good afternoon. You're on the air with Les Brunell.
Well, hello, gentlemen. I'm calling to ask, Wisconsin is a community property state. Is the wife liable for the husband's secret sports gambling debts?
Interesting question. Les, would you know the answer to that?
Well, I'll say I don't know exactly how Wisconsin defines community property, but I do know, let's say we have, you know, if I have a, you know, my wife and I share the credit card together, and I go out and I drop, you know, have $10,000 or $20,000 of credit card debt, you know, that I've lost on, you know, online gambling casinos sponsored by Wisconsin or any other state, like, I'm still liable for that debt. My wife's liable for that, those expenses. If I have a home and I take a home equity line of credit to pay off my debts to the local casino, like she owes that money. Like, you know, so that's money that's on our total debt. So when we say community property, I have to say, I don't know exactly how Wisconsin defines that, but in every other state, you know, you have many people who have been foreclosed on or have liens on their homes because of commercialized gambling debt. You know, that essentially state governments have endorsed, allowed it to happen.
Let's go to Rick in Belleville this afternoon. Rick, you are on the air with Les Brunell, the national director from Stop Predatory Gambling.
Hey, Les. In reference to that other question that previous caller to the young lady that was just on, if you could explain how this works and why, if you continue to gamble at these places, you will always lose your money. For example, if I bet a friend $10 on, say, a Packers game or a Brewers game, and one of us loses, that $20 or that $10 still is maintained. What happens in any kind of organized gambling, there's a percentage of that money, probably around 4 or 5%, that's taken off the top by law. And so, in other words, that money then is being diluted or being removed by the owners of the gambling operation, and therefore it's guaranteed that if you continue to wager, you will always lose because of that guaranteed percentage that they can take off of every dollar that's gambled. I think if people understood that, it'd probably be helpful.
You explained it perfectly. You really did well. And I think it's important, carrying on to that distinction, because some of your listeners may be like, well, you know, because the gambling operators will say, oh, it's like the stock market. The stock market's gambling. And I will say, the point I'll concede on that is, if you're a day trader or you're buying derivatives, yes, that's gambling. But if you're buying a stock, if you're putting money into a Standard & Poor's 500 index fund, and you keep it there for 20 or 30 years, like, you know, you put $1,000 into that or $6,000 into a Roth IRA annually, like, that money's going to grow over 20 or 30 years. You take that $1,000 and put it onto into sports bets or $30 scratch tickets or your slot machines, like, you're going to lose everything. You know, there's a difference between investing and speculation, you know, and I think that's an important distinction. I think the gentleman really explained it very well. So thank you for that.
Finally, Les, this afternoon, if I or someone I know is struggling with gambling addiction, what kind of resources are available to help?
Sadly, there's not a lot of great resources in Wisconsin and elsewhere for people who are suffering from addiction, but there is a problem gambling council in Wisconsin that, has a 1-800 number there. It's called the Wisconsin Problem Gambling Council. There's a number called 1-800-GAMBLER. I mean, I don't usually, you know, the problem is from a public health perspective, the gambling industry funds almost all of the research as well as the treatment in our country on this issue. So that's part of the deal. The business model in commercialized gambling, 50% of the gambling profits come from people who are addicted to gambling. So that's part of that's a whole nother show for you. But this idea of, you know, we got to separate these problem gambling councils from gambling funding, including in Wisconsin. But in the short term, that's your solution, is to call the Wisconsin Problem Gambling Council.
It's 1-800-GAMBLING. Les, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
It's Les Burnell. He is the national director of the nonprofit group Stop Predatory Gambling. And you can continue this conversation on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can email us ideas@wpr.org, because we've been talking about the growth of sports betting and its impact on our economy and our lives. And we'll be seeing it if we have our TV on at any point on Sunday for the big game. So, with a big game in mind, coming up after the news, it's Food Friday, and we're air frying and we're slow cooking and pressure cooking our way through some easy and delicious recipes. If you've got some favorites, you'd like to share them, because for some, our repertoire runs pretty thin when it comes to these fancy home appliances. What do you do with them? We'll find out with our guest James Shend after the news. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today. And coming up, weed in Wisconsin. We'll be joined by a state representative and the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws about the latest push for legalized medical marijuana in our state, as well as the latest on the pushback. We'll also be joined by... that's coming up. But now it's Food Friday and our weekly step into the WPR kitchen. This week, we're getting to know the most popular small appliances that can make our cooking more simple and easy in a big way. Air fryers, slow cookers, and pressure cookers are among the top holiday buys in recent years, but what do you do with them when you get them? Our guest today has some delicious recipes to put them to good use. And you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Do you own an air fryer or a pressure cooker? What do you throw in there? Did you get one as a gift? Is it just sitting there? I'd like to know what you like about them and, what your favorite recipes may be. How do you use them best? Call 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. James Shend is the deputy editor of Taste of Home magazine. James, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
It's Food Friday, and we've got Super Bowl Sunday, and we've got all these appliances that can make things easy and tasty, or so they say, if we use them in the right way. Let's start with the air fryers this afternoon. Can we actually fry food with air, James?
We can, and I was really surprised. I was skeptical when these first started coming onto the market about, what, maybe 10 years or so ago? And if your expectation is to be exactly like a deep fried food, you're not going to quite get there, but will it get you really, really close? Yes, it will. And it does a really good job of it.
So, is cooking with an air fryer healthier than other methods of frying?
Significantly healthier. And because you're using just a fraction, a small, small fraction of the oil. And in most cases, like the recipe that I've shared with you today is like the it's a fried chicken. It's a Nashville hot chicken. And you coat the chicken just like you normally would for deep frying. And then you just spray it lightly with an olive oil spray or like Pam cooking spray, something like that. So you're getting just like a, not even a half a teaspoon of oil on that. And then it crisps up really nicely in the air fryer.
Half a teaspoon of oil to have a darn near deep fried experience. So the Nashville hot chicken, which you would think if it's Nashville hot chicken, it would have to come from a deep fryer. That recipe is available for you now on our website at WPR.org/Food Friday. So take us through this dish a little bit, James Shen. Besides the chicken, what go and the what tablespoon of oil? What else goes in there?
Well, this is a fantastic recipe I first had when I was down in Nashville and was introduced to it. It can be wicked hot depending on where you get it from. But it first starts out by you marinate some chicken with a little pickle juice and some pepper sauce. So like a Tabasco or whatever your favorite hot sauce is. And then you let that sit for an hour or so. You don't need a whole lot longer than that. And then after that, you're going to bread it with a little bit of flour, and then you dunk it in a egg and buttermilk mixture, and then you dunk it back into some flour. And then you spray it with the cooking spray, and you pop it in the air fryer for about, say, maybe 10 minutes or so. And then after it comes out, it's nice and crispy and spicy, and you're ready to go. But what they do differently down in Nashville is they make this chili oil. So it's about a half a cup of olive oil with some cayenne pepper, a little brown sugar to kind of help balance that out, some paprika, chili powder, a little garlic powder. And then they just drench the chicken with it. So when I was talking about it being healthy, we just lost it with the chili oil, but it is so, so good. And it's something I would recommend everyone try. It's not for the faint of heart. If you're not a spicy food fan, I would be a little cautious with the chili oil.
Yeah, that would make sense, but it also sounds delicious. But I mean, we're frying with air here, so a little bit healthier or a lot bit healthier. But what can you say about the taste, James?
The taste is fantastic. I mean, I've done many, many things in the air fryer. And like I said, I was not a big convert up until a little while ago. And what I've found is like things like vegetables, like broccoli, cauliflower, things like that. I just toss in a little bit of olive oil, a little salt and pepper, throw it in there. And in about 8 minutes, it cooks up beautifully. You start to get those little brown bits on the edges. And it's a fraction of the time that it would be in a regular oven. And it does such a really good job of it.
Well, what about
and if you like if you're a fan of tater tots or French fries, yeah. You're going to love the air fryer.
That's exactly where I was going with it, because sometimes, you know, the French fries in the oven just aren't the same as when you go and get them from a deep fryer at a restaurant. But if you could put them in an air fryer and have a similar experience, well, I'd say that sounds like a plan.
And that's it. And like what it's also great for is leftovers. So like I'm a huge pizza fan, and trying to find the great way to reheat pizza is difficult, but the air fryer does it really, really well. Just toss it in there a couple of minutes and it's nice and crispy. The cheese is gooey. It's perfect.
I love that. James Shend, our guest, deputy editor of Taste of Home magazine, as we take a look at the appliances that are in your kitchen and the work that they do for us, taking your suggestions for your air fryer recipes at 1-800-642-1234. And I'm just curious about what. So the vegetables make sense, and my sister's got an air fryer, and if she wants her kids to eat vegetables, that's where they'll go before they end up on the table or on the plate. It just it's an easy way to make a crispy vegetable that is tolerable, maybe for the
taste. It is.
And tasty.
And tasty, too. That, to me, that is the big key, because it's like trying to feed vegetables to kids, it's a hit or miss proposition. And if you steam them or try to cook them on the stovetop, they can go really mushy really fast. And so you have to kind of really know what you're doing. But with the air fryer, it's just a little bit of oil, some herbs if you want, toss it in there, and they get nice and crispy and crunchy and real easy to do.
James, what about cheese curds? Could we make that happen?
Easily. We've got a similar recipe on our site, tasteofhome.com. And the trick to this is you can take the cheese curds, freeze them, and then dunk them in the batter and then freeze them again. And that way is you take them out of the freezer, put them in the air fryer, and then blast them with the heat. Because what happens if you don't have them frozen, the cheese melts before the coating can set.
Yes.
And so you're going to end up with liquid cheese flying around the inside of your air fryer, which is not a fun thing to clean up. We found the trick is to freeze it first.
Perfect. So moving on now from air fryers to pressure cookers. We're frying with air. Are we cooking with pressure, James Shend?
We are. And this has been like grandma's favorite thing for decades. But for some reason, it is like hit the everyone's hot button in the last 10, 12 years. And we're talking Instant Pot here. Yes. For those that are not familiar with that, like electric pressure cooker, Instant Pot, everybody knows. And for some reason, everyone is flopping onto this trend. And it's great. There's a lot of great things about using a pressure cooker for. You save a lot of time. And it does a lot of things that you would normally take hours and hours to cook, can cook in a fraction.
So Maureen wrote on our Facebook page this afternoon saying that she loves her Instant Pot and it makes cleanup incredibly easy. I would imagine compared to like exploding cheese in the air fryer. And Maureen makes soups and stews and yogurt in their Instant Pot.
Yes.
Yogurt, James?
Yes. Yogurt. There's many of the Instant Pot and other manufacturers of them have what is called a yogurt setting on there. And it's very, very simple to do. You just put in whole milk and whatever flavorings you want in the Instant Pot, seal it up, hit the yogurt button, and then walk away.
Whoa.
And then hours later, you come back and you've got perfect yogurt. And there's a number of people in our office that just swear by this and they make yogurt all the time.
James Shend, deputy editor of Taste of Home magazine for Your Food Friday, with a look of at air fryers, pressure cookers, and we'll get to these slow cookers here in a moment, slowly. But give me an idea here, James, what kind of foods work well in pressure cookers and the foods we'd want to avoid.
So the things that work really, really well in a pressure cooker are those tougher, like cheaper cuts of meat. So like the ribs, the shoulder, the pork, not the pork loin, but like short ribs, things like that, that have a lot of those connective tissues that take just a long time to just relax and soften up. And so traditionally you would do this in a braise. And so it'd be like a lot of liquid that you'd have the meat in, and then you'd have it in the oven or on the stovetop, just simmering away for like 3, 4, 9, 10 hours, depending on what it is. A brisket can take up to 12 hours or so. But when you pop it into the Instant Pot, you're cutting that time down to less than an hour.
Mm.
And you get the same great flavor, and it just cooks in so much less time.
So one of the recipes you have for us, James Shend, over at WPR.org/Food Friday, is the pressure cooker pork. Tell us a little bit about this recipe and how we can just walk away and let it do its work.
So the recipe we have is called char siu pork, and it's C-H-A-R-S-I-U. And it's a Chinese dish that has a lot of very familiar ingredients to everybody. So it's hoisin sauce, honey, soy sauce, ketchup, a little ginger root. And then one of the more exotic things is Chinese five spice powder. And so you can find that at any supermarket. McCormick's makes it, Spice Island makes it. So it's everywhere. And it's just a mixture of star anise, fennel, peppercorns, cloves, and cinnamon stick. So they're very familiar ingredients. But when you pop all that into the slow cooker, along with a pork shoulder and then a little bit of chicken broth or water, then you end up with this very like hearty, but very flavorful dish. The pork just shreds like when it comes out. It's this beautiful like sandwich thing, but it's also great for packing for lunches. So it's one of my favorite things to cook.
Feel like we should be munching on a few hors d'oeuvres here this afternoon, James, and tasting these out for the weekend. But your recipes are online at WPR.org/Food Fridays. You can check them out as we continue the discussion with our guest, the deputy editor of Taste of Home magazine, about our air fryers, pressure cookers, and what's next, our slow cookers, as well as your recipes at 1-800-642-1234. How are you using these appliances, and how can we expand your repertoire with a few other menu items, perhaps, to throw in these appliances and make things a little bit easier and tastier for you? 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation and hear from you coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and right now we're picking up our talk with James Shen from Taste of Home magazine. He's here with us talking about the rise in popularity of pressure cookers, air fryers, slow cookers, and we want to hear what you think at 1-800-642-1234. How often do you cook with an air fryer or pressure cooker? Do they make your food taste different than other methods of cooking? Easier, perhaps? And what advice would you have for the rest of us and how to use them right? How did you decide which one to buy? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. And James, a couple of questions here from listeners. One email to ask how an air fryer actually works and how is it different than deep frying?
So the easiest way to explain it is an air fryer is pretty much like a toaster oven on steroids. Okay. And so it's got a fan inside it. So it just heats up the like you would normally would with a toaster oven or a regular conventional oven. But then it's got a fan inside. And depending on the model or the brand of them, the fan can vary as how much intensity. And so there's some that just really get things going inside there and blowing things around. In fact, there's some recipes where we've tested where we put cheese on top of like a burger, and then all of a sudden the cheese is flopping around inside because the fan is so strong. But for the most part, it's just a regular oven that has a fan in there, so it keeps the air moving around it. And then if you just get a little bit of oil on there, then the air acts like almost kind of like a deep fryer somewhat, because it gets that oil hot really fast and then crisps everything up.
Mm. And it does so in a, quite quickly. And as we talked about the pressure cookers, those are a quick meal. And that brings us to the casual cooking of a crock pot or a slow cooking. And so as we look at the different appliances and what's available to us, what do you see as the advantage of cooking something slowly, say, all day in a crock pot, James?
So this, you're hearkening onto one of my favorite ways of cooking food. I love the long, slow cooking. And this is specifically braising, where I mentioned it before with the Instant Pot, where you would do that Chinese pork. You could do it and it just takes a long, slow time in the oven. And the slow cooker does this really, really well. And so it keeps everything cooking at a bubbling away nicely. You don't have to worry about it. And so slow cookers have been around for, holy cow, I can't even think. I remember my mother making things in them when I was about 10. So we're now talking 45 years here. And so they've been around a long time, and they're starting to get, not starting, they've been upgrading them all along. So there's some now that you can brown in them, and they have the removable inserts, and you can go from the slow cooker directly to the stove or the oven if you want, and then directly to the serving table. So there's a lot of advantages to them. And the nice thing about it is you can throw things into it in the morning, go to work, leave them go, and then when you come home, you have a meal already set and waiting for you.
James, one of the questions I always have for a slow cooker is how long is too long? How slow is too slow? When do you know when it's long enough?
So it kind of depends on what it is you're cooking. So there's certain rules that I kind of follow, and we don't kind of deviate them too far when we're at the Taste of Home kitchens. And so like chicken, maximum time for me in a slow cooker is 6 hours max. Because at that point, the chicken starts to overcook and you kind of get that gummy texture where there's no other way to describe it. It starts to kind of stick to your teeth texture, which is not good.
No.
But beef and pork do really, really well for long periods of time. You can cook beef like 10, maybe even 12 hours in a slow cooker. But the other nice function about these is they have warm settings. So you set it to cook for maybe 6 hours and then will switch itself to keep warm So it's not going to cook the food any longer. It's just going to maintain it at that temperature. So if you wanted to cook chicken, but you're not going to be getting home for a few more hours, it'll switch itself to the keep warm setting and we'll just hold it there.
James Shend, our guest, he is the deputy editor of Taste of Home magazine, taking us through our home appliances we'll find in the kitchen and putting them to good use this afternoon. With a little help from you at 1-800-642-1234, some of your recipes for air fryers, pressure cookers, and your crock pot and slow cookers. And James, the slow cooker recipe you've shared with us today is for a frittata provençale. So take us through this. Take us through this dish.
So this is a good one because a lot of people think of slow cookers for dinner, and this one is a breakfast or a brunch. So it's kind of like a quiche, frittatas, quiches. They're all kind of the same thing. It's basically vegetables and meats suspended in egg. Yeah. And so this one is from the south of France, has all those flavors to it. We have a little potato in there, some onion, a little paprika, and then you get the thyme, which is very reminiscent of the southern France. And then you sprinkle a little goat cheese and sun-dried tomatoes in there. And so you're building all of this in a casserole dish. And you have to make sure that the dish fits into the slow cooker. And that's one of the big ones because that hangs up a lot of people. And so then you slowly lower it into the slow cooker. And then you just cook it for like about 3 or 4 hours until it's set. So if you're going to have a brunch, say at 10 o'clock, just put it in at 7 and you're ready to go. You don't have to worry about it in the oven or other taking up space there. Mm-hmm. So this one is a really good one, but this Provençal frittata here is great for lunches. So you can make this up ahead of time, let it cool, and then portion it out and take it to work with you. You can microwave it or you can eat it cold. It doesn't matter. It's a really good way to kind of stretch those dollars and have a really tasty lunch.
Tom from Tomahawk called but couldn't stay with us, and he's been wanting to use beef bouillon in his crockpot stews, and he wonders, they mix the bouillon right in?
Yes, you can. So I'm assuming he's talking like the bouillon cubes.
That's what it
you
sounds
can
like,
also
yeah.
get. Yeah, you can get the bouillon. They have it granules or kind of crushed. So typically what I would do is if you have the cubes, I would just lightly crush them a little bit, kind of help them get a start on the dissolving part. You can even mix them with a little warm water before you add it to the slow cooker.
That makes sense. I'm sorry, I keep going back to the idea of slow cooking eggs, and that just sounds like that would I go back to the question of how long is too long for eggs in a slow cooker, or how do you know when that frittata is done?
So you do it just until the eggs are set. So okay. You can jiggle the whole slow cooker and they will still jiggle a little bit. The firmer you get, the more rubbery it's going to be. Mm. And so you just got to kind of watch it. And so this one's cooked 3 to 4 hours, depending on, again, what kind of slow cooker you have. Because they all they're not the most exact on temperatures. So like a Hamilton Beach may cook a little bit hotter than a Breville. And so you just kind of have to keep an eye on it and get used to your slow cooker. But so we give a little bit wider range, like a 3 to 4 hour thing. But the thing is, you can stick a knife in it. If it comes out clean, you're done. Pull it out. And so you don't want to have those cook too long.
Yeah, that's a good old rule of the knife. It's just if it comes out clean, it's good to go.
Yep.
James Shend, with the last minute we have here, this is we had Carrie from Milwaukee called, couldn't stay with us, but she's, like many, got an air fryer as a present, but it's currently in place holding up a plant. What's the easiest way for her to get into air frying?
So the easiest way is using convenience products. So like if you have... like my son loves Hot Pockets. And so we always have a freezer full of those. So he can pull one out, pop it in there right after school, and it's done. You don't have to worry about it. Those are easy things to start with. Things like tater tots, French fries are also really good. Pop-Tarts are actually really good in an air fryer as well. And so those convenience products are a good gateway to kind of get you used to the machine and what to do with it. Then you can start to get more creative. And so we have recipes that people are making cupcakes and other things like that. You need the silicone cupcake mold that, because most of the cupcake liners that you see are like 6 and they won't fit into an air fryer. So you need the silicone ones. but they bake up beautifully. You can also do cookies. Cookies are great in the air fryer.
James, we're out of time, but I thank you so much for joining us today.
This is my This has been my pleasure.
You bet. We'll do it again. James Shend, deputy editor of Taste of Home magazine. He was with us today sharing recipes for using air fryers, slow cookers, and pressure cookers. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show, Kate Archer Kent brings you the state capitol report and the latest out of Madison. Republican State Representative Jeremy Thiesfeld explains his vision for the future of education in Wisconsin. And Legal Action of Wisconsin joins Kate to explain the potential effects of cuts to public benefits. Bolo, be on the lookout for a giant pickle. Dylan T. Pickle, that is. He's been a mascot for a Portland, Oregon minor league baseball team, and he's been pickle-napped? I don't know. The story has an all-too-common beginning, lost luggage. The Dylan T. Pickle costume first disappeared somewhere inside JFK Airport, with the airline admitting that the packed pickle may be gone for good. That is until yesterday, when the Portland Pickles announced that their mascot had been found and was shipped back home. It was delivered to the baseball team's front door on Wednesday night after business hours, and in an all-too-common ending to this story, the package was stolen right off their doorstep, and Dylan T. Pickle is now gone again. Taken! Quick, somebody check on Bucky. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.